Hello and welcome to Culture with Robert Bound. Now, Rob's been struck down by the changing seasons this week, so for this episode, I'm afraid you're stuck with me, Holly Fisher, producer of the show, and I'm going to talk to you about the thing I love most, audio. I'm guessing if you're listening to this, then you're a podcast fan. Well, you're in good company. We all know that podcast listening is on the rise and increasing numbers of companies and producers are turning to audio for content, but what people still don't quite understand is how these things are made and how you make money off them. While the UK is still mulling that one over, across the pond, Americans have seized this format and developed their own industry, with companies such as Gimlet, Crooked Media and Radiotopia leading the way. On the show today, I'm going to meet one of the US's top podcast makers to find out how it's done and what the UK needs to do to catch up with America. Radiotopia was founded in early 2014 by American radio host Roman Mars, that deep voice you'll know from the design podcast 99% Invisible.
I'm Roman Mars.
It was launched in partnership with PRX, that's the Public Radio Exchange, a creator and distributor of cutting-edge programming across the USA. Radiotopia was created as a network for some of the audio industry's leading podcasts, and probably a few that you listen to.
Radiotopia.
From PRX's Radiotopia, this is Radio Diaries.
You are listening to Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything.
You're listening to Song Exploder.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMayo.
This is 99%
You're listening to Love and Radio.
Invisible.
I'm
Nick Van Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello,
this is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, fire language out of a cannon.
From PRX's Radiotopia.
Coming up in today's show, accents.
Welcome to the heart.
A brand new season of
The Truth.
You're now tuned in to San Quentin's Ear Hustle from Radiotopia.
With almost 20 podcasts under their belts that amount millions and millions of listens each month, Radiotopia has become a trailblazer in how to do good audio. Julie Shapiro is one of the minds responsible for that. She's the executive producer, overseeing all audio that the company releases. Julie's background is in radio. She's worked with the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago and did a stint with the creative audio unit at Australia's national broadcaster, ABC. So she knows a thing or two about making things that you might like to listen to. During a recent trip to the UK for the London Podcast Festival, Julie Shapiro joined me at Midori House.
I think of myself sometimes as a career listener. I have a long history in creative public radio type audio documentary work and feature work. So I first got some early experience in public radio in North Carolina in the States, then moved to Chicago and helped co-found the Third Coast International Audio Festival, which has become just a very sort of the lifeline of independent producing in the States and beyond now. A lot of people come over for it. Did that for about 13 and a half years and then had this great opportunity to spend a couple of years at the ABC, Australian Broadcasting Corporation in Sydney, where I helped launch the Creative Audio Unit. We produced a couple national weekly shows there, and then the sirens of Radiotopia spoke out and lured me back to the U.S. about 2 years ago.
And I read that you actually coined the term Radiotopia.
I did. It's a funny story. So I was working with Roman Mars. He worked with the Third Coast Festival way back when. And at one of the conferences, you know, we always tried to open up each conference each year that we threw with some kind of welcome everybody. And I think just probably out of sleep deprivation on the spot came up with this term. Like it's like we're in a Radiotopia where everything is radio and everything is very good. And yeah, it kind of stuck in Roman's mind. So years later, when he was working with PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, on developing this idea for a network to help independent producers, that name, you know, was still with him. And he called me up and said, what do you think? Can we use it? And I thought it was a great idea. I was really pleased and honored that he wanted to use it. So it stuck.
Radiotopia is 3.5 years in now, and yeah, you've been there for a couple of years. What is your day-to-day job like there?
Wow, it's really different day to day. So the network has 17 shows, 17 podcasts, and they range in style, approach, sound, motivation, ambition, all these things. So my job is to sort of, in the big picture, wrangle and keep everyone going, provide support to the shows independently, think about the future of the network, how we may grow, you know, understand what's going on around us in the industry. I answer a lot of emails. I hear from a lot of people with ideas for podcasts, but I check in very regularly with our producers. I listen to every show when it drops. So that's a lot of listening. And I listen to other things, of course, to know what's going on around us and just things for pleasure every once in a while. But yeah, it's really about communicating a lot and thinking about the Radiotopia Network in the position and sort of the constellation of other networks out there and, you know, trying to figure out how we can best support our producers day to day, but also month to month through marketing, through sponsorship sales, through just moral support, all these things.
And you've got some of the biggest names in podcast on your books. You know, you've got 99% Invisible, The Illusionist, Love and Radio, so many great ones. How do you know when an idea comes through that you've struck gold?
So the Radiotopia started with seven shows back in the day. And those early shows were all sort of colleagues from the public radio world. They knew each other. They knew each other's work. Roman played a large hand in helping invite the first seven aboard, including his show 99% Invisible. And then that was sort of a grand experiment. There weren't a lot of networks out there. But then they kickstarted a fabulously successful Kickstarter project to earn money for the network. And through that, we're able to bring on four more shows. And the concentration then was to bring more women into the fold. So Criminal came on board, which is now one of our biggest shows, and the Illusionist joined then with Helen, and The Heart came on board, and there was one other called Mortified. And then there was another wave about a year later where The Memory Palace and Song Exploder came on, and then another wave. So it's usually not single ideas that catch our interest, but shows that have already done the hard work themselves to gain an audience. We look for ambitious producers who are creative and can innovate and want to do something original. But often with Radiotopia, the shows are already established, and so we're sort of sensing that they kind of fit our sort of picture of the shows and the producers that we want to work with. The one exception to that is we launched a show this summer called Ear Hustle, and that was with brand new producers, and that was a show that came out of a contest that we ran for new talent, and they won the contest, and then, you know, it's a very special podcast that's produced out of San Quentin by inmates and a collaborating visual artist. And that's the one show where that was an idea that came to us and we said, that's the one we want to develop.
We had gotten to an argument. The next thing he said was, you know what? If I want to smoke, I'm going to smoke on my bunk. I ain't going to no door or nothing. He just lit up right there on the bunk.
So it wasn't really about Buck him. It was like, yeah, this is my moment. I need my space to have something in this place.
And I was like trying to hold it in, trying to hold it in. It was just eating at me, and then we just clashed in the cell.
And he was like, man, you're trying to kill me. You're killing me with this. You're going to kill me with cancer. And I would just kind of, I was very dismissive, like, man, shut the fuck up with that shit, man. God, man, we are in prison for life. Like, you know, I have 67 years to life. You have 27 years to life, man. I am smoking this cigarette.
Are you looking to do more things like that, more original ideas that you've come up with?
We would like to. It's really hard in the Radiotopia network model to bring in brand new shows because the lift of going from zero to a sizable audience is huge, but people don't realize it really takes time to grow an audience. You don't flip a switch and get there. Certain things help, definitely, and being in a network helps because you have the support of the shows around you. But we have also started a new show this summer called Showcase, which is a single podcast feed where we're looking for original series. So 7 episodes about this, 4 episodes about that, 6 episodes about this. They're not related to each other. This is now the vessel through which we can invest in some new talent, experiment a little bit, try new content ideas out. And high
above. I'm sure my mother sang to me as much as talked when I was a baby. One of my earliest memories is her singing a Nat Adderley tune while keeping time on the soles of my feet.
Now I reckon that ought to get it, cause I'm working.
Right.
It's just that I liked it, and it was very rhythmic, and when I would be changing you or something, that's what I would do.
Yeah, so you would play it on my feet while you were changing me? Do you think my memory goes back that far?
Of course, I think it does.
No wonder I became a drummer.
And I think that what a lot of people don't understand is how you make money out of audio and podcasts. How have you built a whole company on it?
Right. Well, very few people do in the grand scheme. It's really a small corner of the podcast universe that actually is, you know, thriving with the money. And some people are, there's a lot of money in some small corners of it. But it really, it takes some time. A big part of Radiotopia's success is that Roman partnered with PRX. He was working with PRX at the time. So there was all of this infrastructure. And I think that's the most important thing we offer to our shows is this infrastructure of sponsorship sales, the ads you hear, whether you love them or hate them. Those are the things that keep the shows going. We also provide technical support. This is huge. There's so many ins and outs on the technical back end side of things. We provide huge promotion and marketing. And that's another thing that to, you know, for any show to stand out in the vast ocean of podcasts out there, it needs a lift, some visibility. So we have a very dedicated team between the sponsorship, tech, and marketing to help the shows, you know, grow and ramp up and sustain and hopefully, you know, continue to grow month to month, year to year.
America is obviously the grand force behind podcasts at the moment, and the UK is kind of coming up behind, but still has a long way to go. And I know you've got The Allusionist and The Bugle, which are both British podcasts under your umbrella. What do you think the British podcast industry needs to do to catch up with America?
You know, I feel like it's really catching on here. Maybe British producers don't think so because, you know, the sponsorships aren't there to help support the shows. But I think it's probably just about to boom here because it seems like the success in America was built on some of the finest talent from the public radio system that branched out to make podcasts, and some of the biggest podcasts come from public radio shows. You've got this amazing tradition of, you know, BBC content, and there's great talent coming out of that, and I feel like they're starting to experiment and try to do things. So it's kind of got to be a combination of things. You have to have progressive, willing companies that want to be in front of the listeners. You have to have more people making more content so listeners all over the country hear themselves in these podcasts and have something to choose from. It's a little bit like the momentum picks up and picks up. And I feel like even Radiotopia's presence at the London Podcast Festival this year is a sign that, like, people are over here, they're interested, they're joining up with the community that already exists coming from America. There's a huge barrier with the technology, and still, you know, some people live and breathe podcasts, and have tons of people don't understand what they are. In fact, when I was coming into the country today, the border guy said, "What are you here for?" And I said, "A conference." And he said, "Well, what kind of?" And I said, "A podcast conference." And he said, "Ah." He just totally broke script. He said, "I've been trying to get into those lately." And then I was pitching him on Ear Hustle. It was really funny and ironic. But just to say, I think, like, it's happening right here. It might be a little bit behind the U.S., but the kind of collective consciousness about podcasts, what they might bring to your daily life, it's catching on here. And so I think a little bit of patience, the creative, original content always attracts listeners. I mean, at the end of the day, it's really about excellent content being out there. And, you know, I think America's provided great models for one way for this industry to grow. And certainly things are happening here similar, but I have a feeling that, you know, the UK scene will sort of find its own rhythm and its own supporters, and we'll just be hearing more and more from them.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think there seems to be more of a growing connection between producers as well within the UK that maybe wasn't there before. Yeah. People are linking up a bit more than they used to be. But I think one of the problems is, you know, so many people want a podcast now, but they don't really know what it is. And people think it's cheap, easy, quick content. Do you think this is really damaging to the podcast industry?
It is, because it floods the, you know, it floods the field with mediocre to poor content that just turns people off. It doesn't excite them. I mean, the top podcasts in the U.S., now there's a few pockets. There's the comedy scene and the talk scene and then the storytelling scene. Of course, I'm most familiar with the storytelling scene. And that, you know, the people at the top of that scene are largely people who've been working in the business for years and years and, you know, honing their skills and developing their voices. So it doesn't come easy or fast to anyone. And I get questions all the time, again, like, how do I build my audience? And, you know, it just takes hard work, and it takes consistent hard work over a certain amount of time for it to catch on and for someone to become natural. And, you know, the more natural the hosts are, the more authentic the connection is with the listeners. And that all just takes, it's just like relationships you have to build. It takes time, just, you know, outside of podcasting. But I think, not to discourage people getting into it, you need that excitement. The people who are making are also the listeners. You know, it's as important to build the communities locally. And then, you know, I think some of those people will rise to the top and the shows will grow and they'll like sort of step into leadership roles in the whole larger podcast community. It's just what happened. I mean, being at Third Coast, I was very aware of this happening in the radio field. And like that has largely transferred in lots of ways to the podcast field. And it is so much about community. I think you're completely right on that front.
And I think so as well, when you have companies who want to podcast, I mean, we're sitting here in a building that was originally just a magazine and then they decided they wanted a radio station. But they kind of understood that, you know, you need a team and you need to pay them and all that. But
that's
People just don't understand that, you know, the time and effort and the money that needs to go into it.
And so it's a little bit on the producers to make a case for it. I mean, you could go convince anyone they need a podcast. I remember early on thinking Purina Dog Chow, do you know, that's it's an American dog food company. I remember thinking like they probably, you could, like a smart producer could convince them they need a podcast, right? They have a pod, like a year ago, I noticed there's actually a Purina podcast. But just to say like anyone and everyone could and should have them. Nobody knows what it takes. So it's really on the producers to understand the economy, the money side of it, and to explain and to make sure they're not setting themselves up to fail and that the companies really believe in it. So, you know, again, it's baby steps, but the more it happens, I think companies will start hearing other companies with podcasts, and these things do start to catch.
And just going back to the UK versus USA thing, one of my theories as to why maybe British people haven't been as successful yet is that Americans are better orators, are better spoken stories than British people. I think maybe we need to get some Americans over to give us lessons in how to tell stories.
Well, that is a very kind way of saying another thing, which I find, you know, we're also loud and we talk a lot and we're not afraid to take the mic and draw attention to ourselves. So those happen to be helpful podcast skills if you're trying to, you know, a lot of the podcasts that are very popular have charismatic hosts that people really identify with or want to know better or just love to hear. So you've got this very extroverted kind of sensibility that works really well in the podcast equation. And, you know, for better or worse, I don't always love that part of it, but I think it has certainly in the vast majority that are like guys sitting around talking about things, you know, that a lot of people like to listen to those things and get really attached to those guys behind the microphone. So there's a bit of outward exuberance and entitlement that comes from some of the American podcasts that happens to please listeners that you may not find come so naturally here.
And from your roles at Third Coast and in Australia, you must hear audio from all around the world. Mm-hmm. And you don't really hear that much about podcasts from other places apart from UK and USA. Are there any other places that you know of that are making really interesting stuff at the moment?
I really think Australia's onto it as well. It was starting to pop when I was there, and it's just they're just going deeper. There's a great conference coming out of Sydney called Audiocraft, very much in the model of Third Coast, pulling producers together to talk not just about the business, but about the making of this. And here's another trend I see that in the U.S., there's a lot of buzz and industry talk and jargon. And what I think suffers in all of that is the content conversation. And, you know, it's just as important to train and inspire and share skills along the content as it is to understand how to go after sponsors and, you know, promote yourself and understand how to buy Facebook ads and things like that. It's all part and parcel, and you need both sides, but the content part is really, really important. So, yes, I think Australia is coming up. You know, I'm most familiar with most of the English-speaking countries doing it. Ireland has a scene that's we're hearing more and more from there. Canada, the CBC is actually backing a lot of really young and interesting, not experimental, but producers who are experimenting. So I haven't heard as many other languages. There's, you know, for a country like America that has such a huge Spanish-speaking population, there just aren't that many Spanish podcasts. There are a few that we know of in the storytelling, and there must be more that aren't on my radar because I don't speak Spanish myself. But there's a great potential there, of course. And I think, you know, it's true that it's a relatively inexpensive technology to produce and to get out there. So in theory, you can do it for free. So it hopefully it's catching on in other places. I've heard podcasts like out of Africa that are about African culture, not always by African producers, but, you know, there is something waking up there, which I'm very excited to keep an ear on.
In Radiotopia, how are you looking forward into the future? Are you looking to stick with what you've got at the moment and keep focusing on the podcast you've got, or are you looking for new content?
such a good question that I think about all the time. I want to grow very slowly. I think we must grow a little bit every year to sort of, it feels like a living organism. It has to grow a little bit. But we have to be smart about not spreading our resources too thin. We also have a wide range of shows in Radiotopia. So some have smaller audiences, some have bigger audiences. The goal in moving forward is to fill in some of the gaps. So we want to have a few more diverse hosts and producers, content-wise, background-wise, topic-wise, style-wise. You know, we're stretching the tent poles on the kinds of shows we're bringing in and supporting as well. So I think going forward, though, you know, we want women, we want people of color, we want people who we don't have as many of in the network yet, and that's really important to us. And that's the step I see us taking in the next 6 to 8, 12 months.
And just finally, do you have a favorite ever episode of a podcast? I have one.
Oh, you go first and I'll think while you're telling me.
Okay, well, my favorite ever episode is a Love and Radio episode. I can't remember what it was called, but it's the one where the woman's looking through the window at the couple.
The living room.
Yeah, the couple in the other building.
That one's really
startling. It's really, really well made. It comes back to me all the time.
And over half a block of gardens and across a small street, there was this bright window that I'd never noticed before. But it's at the exact eye level of my third floor apartment. And after a while, I realized that I'd never seen it because there had always been curtains. And so it was always, I think, dimly lit. The curtains were often closed. And all of a sudden, there's this bright light and no curtains. And it was like a movie screen. Years, and that window has meant nothing. I haven't even noticed it. And now it's all I think about.
Well, you know, I could tell you 15 episodes off the top of my head. You know, it changes, isn't it? But the one that I think about a lot, because I think it did something remarkably brave, there was a podcast called 74 Seconds, which investigated the shooting of an African-American man in Minneapolis, Philando Castile. And they reported it, you know, this sort of live, there's been a lot of live podcasts going along with news stories and as they unfold new reports from there. And they did a fairly excellent job of getting to the story and getting to know him through people who knew him and trying to talk to all sides. And then one episode toward the end, the reporter just said, "I just got the list of what was in his car when he was shot." And they just read a beautiful, heartbreaking list of all the tiny, tiny detailed things, a receipt from here, a plastic bag from there, leftover food from here, groceries from here.
A jug of laundry detergent, Bahama Breeze scent, a gallon of bleach, an ice scraper, a flyer for Cub Foods advertising 18 eggs for 99 cents. A black t-shirt with marijuana leaves formed into a Nike-style swoosh. A pair of crisp white sneakers, still in the box, surrounded by crumpled up paper.
And it spoke so much without being a report. It was literally a list of things in his car. And I was glued. I was so upset afterward. Like, it was so affecting and effective and evocative. And I thought, this is like an example of what you can do with this form. Yes, you can do actual current event news reporting in a very professional way. I trusted them as reporters, but then this was like an art piece thrown into the middle of the series. And it really, I was so struck by how brave that was, and yeah, I thought it was great.
A stack of yellow time cards from St. Paul Public Schools, a completion certificate for a CPR course with Philando Castile's name on it, a Sports Illustrated from 2015 with Minnesota Timberwolves' Karl Anthony Towns on the cover, a piece of children's art made with crayons and a glue stick, a tourist guide to South Dakota, a box of brake pads, a bottle of water, a roll of red lens repair tape for taping over a broken brake light.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks to Julie Shapiro, executive producer at Radiotopia. You can find out more about all of their podcasts at radiotopia.fm. You've been listening to Culture with Robert Bound. Tune in at the same time next week when Rob will be back and reporting from the Listen Gallery's major new exhibition with the Vinyl Factory that's launching on the Strand as part of Frieze this week. But for now, I've been Holly Fisher. Thanks for tuning in.